Brace the rudder! Raise the sails! Raise the sails!
Captain, an unidentified ship approaching. Over.
Roger that. Wait, is that an Enterprise sails solution?
Reach sales professionals, not professional sailors. With LinkedIn ads, you can target the right people by industry, job title, and more. To get £100 off your first campaign, go to linkedin.com/lead to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/lead. Terms and conditions apply.
Hola, bienvenidos a Las Paleteras, your go-to podcast that's as vibrant and bold as our community. I'm Cesar Camacho.
And I'm Ana Sheila. We're three queer Latinx artists here to serve you una mezcla de chisme and insightful conversation.
Y yo soy Nalgona. Together, we're totally unfiltered and ready to dive into the good, the bad, and the ugly of our lived experiences.
Each week, we'll be offering you una paletita para tus oídos, sabrosa, picosa, y peligrosa.
So get your paletas ready.
Relax and enjoy your time with Las Paleteras. Las Paleteras.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Immigrantly. I'm your host, Nadia Khan. I hope all of you are taking care of yourselves, paying attention to your surroundings, are aware of your rights, and make sure you're getting your news from reliable sources and multiple places. Because you know what? Getting your news from one place doesn't work anymore. Be informed through your research. It is so important to be more aware and intentional about what's happening around us. Talking about intentional, Ramzan Mubarak to those who are observing. Now, I find the first few days tricky. I mean, you have to fast all day, but then the spirit kicks in. You know, it's a time of spiritual reflection, self-discipline, and deep compassion. It's a month of fasting and prayer, yes, but of communal connections, reminding us of the values of gratitude, generosity, and empathy for those in need. So yeah, I am so humbled by this experience every year. But I'm also thinking about Eid and what I'll wear and who I'll hang out with and what I will eat. All of that is what also keeps me going, guys. To be honest, that's also something that I think about a lot. Those who know me know I've always been fascinated by stories that really challenge the way we think, especially about things like success. And when these stories come from people who've had to reinvent themselves over and over again. And today's guest, she's the definition of reinvention. Dr. Neri Kara's story is nothing short of remarkable. She was born into a Turkish minority in Bulgaria and as a child was forced to flee with her family when political tensions made it impossible for them to stay. Imagine that. Leaving behind everything, you know, carrying only what you can and stepping into the unknown. Fast forward to today and Neri is a powerhouse. She built a global luxury brand, consults for top fashion companies, teaches entrepreneurship at Oxford, and even holds a PhD from Cambridge. Neri is also the author of the book called Pioneers, 8 Principles of Business Longevity from Immigrant Entrepreneurs. How incredible is that? But here's what really intrigues me. How does someone go from being a refugee to a leader in the luxury fashion world? How do you take those early struggles and turn them into something extraordinary? And this is a big one. How do you make sure success doesn't come at the expense of your values? Well, that's exactly what we are getting into today. So let's dive in. Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
I've been listening to your interviews, watching your TED Talk. There is so much to unpack in your story and in your conversation. But one thing that I've noticed is your story is of constant reinvention, right? From being a refugee to an entrepreneur and an academic. But reinvention often means letting go of past versions of your identity. Have you ever faced or struggled with the idea of shedding parts of your identity to evolve into somebody else?
I don't think I struggled with it. I think it happened very naturally. But that's a very good and accurate way to put it. I don't think I even consciously sat down and thought about what it was and that it was reinvention. But you are very correct. In fact, recently I was actually thinking that in every year, at the age of 11, I became a refugee. Age of 20, we started our family business. 30, I ended a relationship and set out on my own and got into academia. 40 is when I met my husband and I became a mother. So let's see what 50 brings. Fingers crossed, it's a good one.
I love the way you classify it. Going back to being a refugee in Turkey, now you were born in Bulgaria in a Turkish ethnic minority family, right? But your family had lived there for generations and you were forced to flee. And I was listening to one of your interviews where you talk about how you felt at the time that education was so necessary. If you were to achieve something in life as a refugee, that's like at 10, 11, that's going through your mind. Education is what you decided to focus on, which is incredible. But I kept thinking, education or lack of education was not the reason your family had to flee Bulgaria. It was racism. It was ethnic discrimination. Did that experience at the time change your relationship with your own identity? How did you start looking at your Turkish identity when you were forced to flee a country that had been your home for generations?
Gosh, that's such a good question. Very loaded question too. Actually, that's something I've struggled with very much so. Trying to understand, people will ask me, where are you from? And it's even very difficult to answer this question. I used to say I'm Turkish Bulgarian, and I still say that. So sometimes people think my mom is Bulgarian or my dad is Turkish, because that's what the assumption is. Growing up in Bulgaria, you are told that you are a Turk. I am growing up in a Muslim Turkish family. And in the 80s, speaking to each other in our own native language becomes prohibited. Our names are changed and we have to really almost run away. And we did run away in order for our names not to be changed. But then once we become immigrants, once we become refugees and we are in Turkey, and in fact in Bulgaria, because of that discrimination, I remember how my grandparents would tell us, you know, once we are in Turkey, all of this will end. And in fact, my grandmother, may she rest in peace, she would describe us this country that was full of beauty. We are talking about Turkey. And the streets will be covered in marble. There will be golden faucets. She's describing heaven. I'm a child, so I believe that. So whenever we will have these troubles, I think it was our way of coping. It was coping mechanism. So when we became refugees, we are in an immigrant camp, and also we left our grandparents behind, uncles, aunts, all of our families left behind. When we are in a refugee camp, it's muddy. It's not nice. In fact, in order to get out of the refugee camp, we didn't have money. And my father stopped the truck driver alongside other families on top of that truck. He drove us from the refugee camp to Istanbul. Very challenging times, but you see, I understood that the language that we are speaking is not Turkish, really. It's a dialect. Most often, we are either made fun of in Turkey when we speak in our dialect, and we also couldn't understand some of the time what was being talked about. So it was quite challenging, and I struggled, and I still struggle with identity. I think I created my own identity by choosing a name. I changed my name myself around the age of 20-something when I knew I could, and we were able to get our passports and identities from Bulgaria. It's a little bit like Phoebe in Friends, you know, the where she chooses the name Princess Banana Hammer. I thought I'm going to choose Nerikara. Why not?
So you have a passport from Bulgaria now.
Yes, I do. And a Turkish passport as well.
I am curious, how did that feel when you got the passport?
It's okay, because that's the distinction. I want to clarify something, because it's not Bulgarian people. It was the communist government that decided to carry out this ethnic assimilation process. My friends are Bulgarian to this day. I love Bulgaria as a country. It's one of the most beautiful countries. And I love the people of Bulgaria because, to me, they are very humble, very hardworking, and very smart people. I do separate communist regime at the time, which was led by Todor Zhivkov, versus the people. So when we were hiding from the Gestapo, so our names will not be changed, we sometimes stayed in Bulgarian people's homes. They opened their homes to us, our neighbors. And when it was time for us to escape Bulgaria, we did that thanks to a Bulgarian police officer who was friends with my father. So it doesn't feel weird. The only thing is, I definitely don't feel a sense of belonging to either country. So in terms of you asking me a question about identity, I still struggle with that.
That makes sense. But then what part of your identity is more Turkish than Bulgarian?
Customs.
Hmm.
Definitely. The customs I grew up with, knocking on wood, saying mashallah, inshallah, I have to say that. This type of customs are definitely a lot more Turkish.
So Neri, you moved to Turkey with your family. Now, from being that 10, 11-year-old girl to establishing your own business in 2000, how did that come about?
I was very much focused on education, as you mentioned. And in the meantime, my parents were focused on making a living, which was even to put bread on the tables. So my father met a Turkish, we all met him actually when we were in Bulgaria. He gave my father his business card and he said, I have an atelier making wallets in Istanbul. So my father worked in construction, worked as an illegal cab driver, did all kinds of work in order to just put food on the tables. Any job he could find. My mother the same way.
Standing on top of the Berlin Wall, which for years has been the most potent symbol of the division of Europe. And there can be few better illustrations of the changes which are sweeping across this continent than the party which is taking place here on top of it tonight.
And then the communism ended, the Berlin Wall fell, and people from Russia started to come to Turkey to buy whatever goods they could find and bring everything back to Russia, former Soviet Republic, sell it on the street because there were no stores, and then come back again. We spoke Russian. We speak Russian because in communist Bulgaria, this is mandatory. You start learning the language from the age of 8. So the interesting part here is that we felt a lot closer to people who also were coming from communism than to the local Turks.
I
PSA for anyone who rents. If you haven't heard of Built, you are about to thank me. Earning points on rent is now a reality when you pay your rent through Built. You don't even have to check with your landlord to start earning points that you can use toward flights, hotel stays, fitness classes, and even your next rent payment. Let me break it down for you. There's no cost to join Built, and as a member, you'll earn valuable points on rent and on your everyday spending. Built points can be transferred to your favorite hotels and airlines, and even the ones you haven't heard of. There are over 500 airlines and 700,000 hotels and properties around the world you can redeem your Built points toward. Points can also be redeemed towards a future rent payment and unique experiences that only Built members can access. How incredible is that? So, if you're not earning points on rent, my question is, why not? Start earning points on rent you're already paying by going to joinbuilt.com/immigrantly. That's joinbilt.com/immigrantly. Make sure to use our URL so they know we sent you. joinbuilt.com/immigrantly to start earning points on your rent payments today.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
That's a really interesting part here, because you started your questions with the identity question. So I think that's an interesting one. And then my father found the guy. He kept that business card for years, went to him and said, I have a proposal for you. I would like to sell your wallets. Let's open a store together. I'm telling you a very short summary. Let's open a store together in the Grand Bazaar area. And then I will make a small commission, 1% from the goods that I sell. And the brand became very big at the time in Russia. It was my mom and my dad doing this. At the age of 16, I started to work as a translator to the same company, taking them to Italy, to England, but especially to the suppliers, leather suppliers, doing translations. And basically, my parents were selling leather goods, and I was doing the translation, helping them with the branding, because I remember I came up with a slogan, quality for all for quality, something like that. I liked Bryan Adams at the time, that's why. So anyway, I went to University of Miami to study, and it was in one of my courses where I had to write a business plan. So I wrote a business plan for our own brand. What if we had our own family business? What if my father didn't make a commission only? What if we work with the leather suppliers ourselves? And what if they gave us their leather for free or for very cheap, the leather that they were throwing away or not using? So that basically became the foundation of our business. And when I went back to Turkey, we started very small. We made mobile phone cases and wallets. And then we took them to our existing clients. Most of them said no, but that's the beauty of entrepreneurship. You just keep going. That was in 2000.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history. Yes.
It is such a profound story of resilience, success, of grit. Now you have built this world of luxury fashion around your brand. And you talk a lot about durability, but you don't like the term sustainability. You're not quite taken by it. Why?
I don't, because even like today, I had a question from a journalist. What do we do when it comes to DEI sustainability initiatives? And my answer is, if you are going to change your initiatives, it means it was just pure marketing. It wasn't built into your competitive advantage. It wasn't built into your business, into your strategy.
That's an interesting point.
Yes, because I never really liked the term that almost everyone uses, but they don't even know what it means. You see the word sustainability on a toilet paper these days, right? it's wedding dresses, toilet paper. And I think if we move away from such terms into the heart of what sustainability means, which is long-lasting, good quality, repairable, something you can be proud of, something that you can even leave to the next generation, where it's honest, hard work, rather than something that you can just sell a lot of. I think that's the distinction I would like to make.
So you like the term durability better?
I do. High quality durability, because you can't have something that is sustainable, repairable, and circular unless that item is high quality, unless it's well made. So I think for me, when we were starting our business, we weren't thinking sustainability. It was just the way to do business. You want to buy the highest quality leather. You want to use the best products available out there. You want to do it and make it and create it in the best possible way. And it's about integrity as well.
But Nay, doesn't that warrant exclusivity, which also means that it is not for everyone?
Actually, our brand, the way I talk about it, maybe you will think it's at the price of Gucci and Prada. It is not. We have wallets. We actually never put very high markups, because when you put a high markup, you also have to invest in marketing, PR. So the way we built our business was very different. We never invested in marketing and PR per se, but we invested in the quality of the product. And it was a wholesale product as well from the very beginning. So this allowed us to create less of a markup. So it's very high quality, very well made, but it's at affordable, accessible prices.
But that's your brand, right? You also work with a lot of luxury fashion brands, and they are exclusive and they are very expensive. A lot of people cannot afford them. So how do you think about this tension between exclusivity and inclusivity, both in fashion and in your life? You've experienced exclusion in your life, right? So how do you reconcile with that in fashion?
I think the two are a little different, in my opinion. So when it's exclusivity, I think it's not same as exclusion, in my opinion. So the way I felt excluded, but it was for a different reason. With luxury brands, I think that's very different.
How so?
Because with luxury brands, you have a higher price, but I don't think it's the same thing. I don't think luxury brands have this animosity. With the kind of exclusion you are talking about, I think there is a little bit of an animosity behind. The intention is very different.
But there is this stratification. People are excluded, those who cannot afford to buy those brands. They may feel alienated. And again, we can go into consumerism and why should it matter. But I just want to understand how you think about it. Even if we were to remove direct comparison with exclusion, there is exclusivity with these brands. How do you justify that?
If we are talking about the fashion industry, I've myself said it's a highly problematic industry. not just in terms of exclusivity, but about even fast fashion companies. Okay, you can say their prices are affordable, but they are killing you at the same time. Today, if you look at the Zara item, when you look at the composition, now they say this product is releasing microplastics into the environment. So there is always that question of, do you buy one item, but buy something, okay, it may be more expensive, but you know that it will be well made. Having said that, I do agree. It's a very problematic industry, and we now have seen some luxury brands producing their products in maybe in Italy, but they are using slave labor. On the other hand, you have overconsumption, overproduction. The very essence of the fashion industry is telling you, you are not enough. You need one more bag. You need yet another face cream. It's the beauty and fashion industry. You need this item in order to feel good enough about yourself. So I think that's more problematic. And my hope is we start to become a lot more aware as consumers, how we spend our money, who we think our role models are.
Who is your role model?
Oh, gosh, it's Oprah. I will tell you why. Well, I do have several role models. One of them is my friend Annabella, who I met when I moved to London, and she has a beautiful jewelry brand. Ayşe Birsel, who is leading a thought leader and a product designer. Oprah has been a role model for many, many years. When I moved to US, I listened to Oprah almost every single day, and her story of making it despite the odds, persevering, really spoke to me. She had a very difficult life in some ways. She faced challenges, but she achieved the impossible.
As a business leader, as an entrepreneur, how are you mentoring the next generation of, I don't want to use the term leaders, but maybe visionaries in their own right?
Very good question. I teach, so I think that's one way. I love teaching, and I think that's a way to tell the subject I'm teaching, our entrepreneurship and business strategy. But even when I teach those subjects, I want to bring in what you don't necessarily see in business book.
And that is?
For example, balancing profit and purpose really works in real life. The tension that you were talking about, because it's not so easy. And I want to bring in the reality of what it is to run a business and other things such as kindness, shared value, shared purpose, building a community. These are the kinds of elements. They are touched upon in business literature, but not necessarily in this way. Even creating a vision or mission statement, it's usually spoken and told in a very dry way. And I do mentor some students who have approached me, who have asked me to be their mentor. And, you know, if they have any challenges or they are asking me for which direction to go, I'm always here and available for them. So that's much more on an individual level.
You know, as a fellow immigrant, I have a very strong relationship with nostalgia. There's so much that I connect with when I look back, when I see my journey. As a business leader, do you see economic value to nostalgia? Do you think that it brings something to the story that entrepreneurs are telling or the way they connect with their consumers? What value, if any, do you subscribe to nostalgia in your life?
That's a very good question. What creates the foundation of a long-lasting business? So I have written a book and I interviewed immigrant entrepreneurs and profiled immigrant entrepreneurs in my book. Example came to my mind, Hamdi Ulukaya, the founder of Chobani. He comes from a shepherd family, and the way he talks about his business is in a very nostalgic way. He talks about the mountains and the community he grew up in, where money wasn't an exchange, but it was just the kindness and how you were with each other. You didn't have money. Being Turkish, I know exactly what he is describing. But today, the business that he built, you can see Chobani is built on those values. Not only just the yogurt making, but he places huge importance on community, on giving back. He hires refugees, he supports them. He cares about where the business is physically located, and he prospers those towns. He describes the story when he first goes to see the craft factory and the town where the craft factory was, and he says, the second I entered the town, I can see sadness. I can feel people were sad. And because the factory closed, and that was the lifeline of that town. And he rebuilds it, and he rebuilds it with the people who worked in that factory. And this is such a communal way to think about business. And this is, in my opinion, the heart of his business.
Now you teach at Oxford, which is incredible. And you mentioned your book. But there are things, in my opinion, that classrooms cannot teach. If you were to pick the intellectual exercise that you undergo as a teacher versus experiential wisdom that you've had, what are some of the gems that you will pick from both?
They are both very important. I actually can tell you in terms of like real life, how I apply what I teach in the classroom. I think I understand that, when we talk about academia or classroom, it can feel like it's just a theoretical exercise, but it really is not. Because as we started building our own business, and maybe because the way I think about almost everything is in a very academic way, I realize that now. So when we were building our own business, it was very methodical, structured. And while the day-to-day operations may look very different than what you will see in a classroom, you still are applying what you are learning at school, in business school. So about competitive advantage, in 2008, when we hit a financial crisis and our largest distributor decided to no longer work with us. It was a huge, it came out of left field, and it was very challenging times for us. So what do you do in that moment? You have to pivot. And for me, it was, what is our competitive advantage? I always ask this question to myself, even in my personal life, like when I faced professional challenges, I will go back to this question.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how ambitious do you think you are?
1,000. I am very ambitious. I have embraced it now. And I think it's a good thing to be ambitious.
Has your ambition ever clashed with your values?
No, absolutely not.
How do you keep yourself grounded while being ambitious?
I think being ambitious is about what ambition is, it's not winning at all costs, but creating a life where you live a good life, but you are also giving back and you are doing something of value. Because for me, you can't have true success unless even as a thought leader, even as a business owner, you need to give something of value to other people. So ambition to me doesn't mean just getting to the top or becoming highly, highly successful. But I certainly wanted to get a good education, do the very best that I can do. That's ambition. Create a successful business for my family. And that business allows other people to have successful lives as well.
But as immigrants, I feel we are always boxed into these ideas of ambition being a virtue and an expectation of how successful we can be. Do you think this expectation of being successful, especially from immigrants, takes away from part of their humanity? Because people always measure our worth within the parameters of how successful we are economically. So we become an economic marker for the society that we adopt.
I didn't find the expectation to be external on me necessarily, but I think maybe US is a little bit different story, I would say. But the issue that I have, Sadia, is how it's about language, how we talk about immigrants. And I've started to notice it even more and more recently, where immigrants are either seen as a problem that they have to be solved, or someone, you know, a group that needs to be pitied and helped. Or even now I'm talking about stories of success from immigrants. It's just not even important to talk about that. Like, you know what I mean?
And that's exactly what I'm thinking. Rather than focusing on that binary of either success or failure, victims or villains,
yes,
or having some economic value, we really don't talk about their lived experiences.
I agree.
Are living life. You and I, we watch TV, we go play games, we spend time with our friends, we hang out, we have relationships outside our immigrant identity. And very few people are talking about that. Going back to your book, I was reading your LinkedIn post today. You talk about failure and success in parallel, which I love. Thank you for doing that. A lot of people focus so much on success. It becomes unattainable for others. So thank you for saying that it wasn't easy, but now you have a book. Talk to me about the journey that you underwent and how are you feeling about it now?
So the book, it's an interesting one, and I'll tell you a backstory. I don't think I talked about it before, other than to my mom and dad, I guess. But if you are talking about the latest LinkedIn post, I've written the book proposal, and it was about the resilience. And I have had a ton of rejection, a ton. But of course, I was revising it and sending it again. It took close to almost 2 years. And then one evening I was sitting here and basically my husband said to me, why are you not writing about what you know, which is immigrant entrepreneurs? And do you know, Sadia, I said, why would anyone want to read that?
Neri.
Because it's me, you see? And this is how we are programmed.
We are so self-deprecating, aren't we?
Absolutely. It's our culture, or it's the immigrant experience or something. And deep down, and in my PhD, one of my topic actually was ethnic entrepreneurship. So I know the subject. And I am myself one. And I thought, to be honest, I think it's not, nobody will want to read this. Of course, but the next day, I did some Google search and I come across these exceptional statistics. Exceptional. close to 50% of Fortune 500 companies are founded by immigrants. 8% of the unicorns have an immigrant founder or an executive who leads the company, and they actually last longer, the businesses that are founded by immigrants. I mean, I'm quite a curious person, so I start to read a lot more, and that's how the proposal came together, the new proposal. But you see, this is an interesting point here. My initial reaction was, why write about us? You know, why write? Who will want to read this?
And I was having this conversation with somebody recently. Immigrants don't own their immigrantness themselves, and especially successful ones. You know what's really fucked up? As you said, there are so many immigrant entrepreneurs from all over the world, right? But they don't talk about, yeah, I'm an immigrant and I'm successful and I'm living life. Very few own it. I have friends who think that immigrants should talk about certain topics and not beyond. So we are doing it to ourselves. I kid you not. We need to change that mindset as a community, individually. We haven't expanded that space. We haven't.
Very few, yes.
So tell me, what were some of the most interesting, surprising stories for you? Give me a story. And you mentioned Chobani's founder. Give me another story of an immigrant that you sat down with, had a conversation, and you were just blown away.
For me, it was Isaac Larian.
This is the journey of Isaac Larian, the visionary behind some of the world's most beloved toys. Think Bratz and LOL Surprise. Isaac's journey began at the age of 8, navigating the bustling bazaars of Iran. Fast forward to 17-year-old Isaac, wandering the streets of Los Angeles with only 25 cents in his pocket and searching for any work to survive. He went from...
I didn't have the chance to actually sit down with him despite me just sending him a lot of emails. It just didn't happen because I also had a limited time frame to conduct my interviews. But I was able to listen to all the other podcasts and read everything that is out there about him. So it was quite interesting. He comes from Iran with just a few dollars in his pocket, takes a yellow blanket that his mom made for him, cries all the way to Los Angeles in the flight from Iran to Los Angeles, to the point where the flight attendants are coming to him, giving him food, and he's only 16, 17 years old. He tries to find a job. Every day he's walking for hours and hours and hours, leaving just 7-Eleven, gas stations, restaurants, cafes, no job at all. He doesn't know anybody. And one day he walks into this restaurant and he's asking for a job. They say, no, we don't have any job. He goes outside and he's just so feeling sorry for himself and sits down, puts his hands on his head. He's crying when someone taps him on the shoulder and says, are you Iranian? It's the chef of the restaurant, and says to him, come here after 11 o'clock, and gives him food and says, okay, you can start the night shift. It will be only $1.65. He takes the job. He puts himself to school. He's an engineering graduate. He starts selling, basically takes these electronic products with his brother. He starts a business. It's doing well, but it's obviously not very high level. And then he starts to import Nintendo, but it's not so easy. He really wants to do it, but Nintendo says, no, we are not interested in distributors in US. And he keeps going, he keeps trying, he sits at the lobby of Nintendo trying to speak to the CEO. And it's very interesting because he's being told no so many times, but despite that, he perseveres. So when you ask him, but why didn't you give up? And he says, I heard no, that's the beginning of business. And I heard that from Haim Saban. I heard that from Jane Wurwan, the founder of Dermalogica. I heard that from the founder of V, Larry Louis. I heard that from Dominique Ansel. Every single entrepreneur has that in common. But, and you will say, okay, this is a characteristic for entrepreneurs in general, because you have to be comfortable with no. But with especially immigrant entrepreneurs, they don't hear the word no the same way. So I talk about that in my book a lot, about it's one chapter, reframing.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting and so true. It really resonates with me. As an entrepreneur, as someone who's trying to build from the ground up, it is not easy. And you're right. No becomes your friend. Failure becomes your companion, because failure is one step closer to success.
Absolutely.
What is the book called?
It's called Pioneers, 8 Principles of Business Longevity from Immigrant Entrepreneurs.
Give me your favorite 3 principles that you learned.
One is the power of community. And that's really important, having a shared value and reframing, which we just talked about, reframing the past, failure, rejection. But there's a principle that I talk about in conclusion. And it's not really a principle. It's the glue that holds all these principles together. And that's kindness. That didn't occur to me as I'm doing my interviews, doing my research, writing the book during months of June, July, August, September, October, and I'm coming towards the end of the book. I need to write the conclusion. And it was almost like this revelation revealed itself to me. This is the hidden secret. And it holds all the principles together, because without kindness, you don't have none of the principles will function.
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
So, you see, and I've just written an article about this and sent it to my editor. But in business, you don't necessarily talk about kindness. You don't have like a course on kindness. You have a course on competitive advantage.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's what we can talk about when we say in terms of like how it's different than the classroom, because in the classroom, you will not have a separate course on kindness.
You're so right. In fact, I would go as far to say kindness is undervalued. It may be seen as a liability in some instances, right?
Absolutely. Because then you risk the danger of being not taken seriously. You are gullible. You are, especially for women.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
You run the risk of being taken advantage of or being thought as not competent enough.
Oh my gosh, Neri, I will be reading this book for sure.
Thank you.
I am so glad we had a chance to sit down, have this fun conversation. In the end, Neri, I always ask my guests to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence. I know these days, I don't even know what and how to define it anymore. But if you were, how would you define it?
Oh my God. If I'm to define United States in one word.
Or a sentence.
Well, I would define it as hope. I know it doesn't sound like...
It doesn't sound like it right
like
now.
Like it right now. I know that. But I haven't given up, because that's why I say hope.
You are a true entrepreneur. You're not going to give up, right?
That's right. That's right. I refrain. I don't see... That's very true about me, I have to say. Like, I know what is going on in the US at the moment. It's totally... like left field in some ways. It's quite surprising. I almost said mishmash when you were asking me, but I chose not to say that because I am hopeful. I do think I love US. And I think it's an exceptional country with exceptional people. And that's why I am hopeful.
People, go buy Neri's book. I will definitely be buying one. And who knows, we may give it as a giveaway as well. Where can people find this book?
It's available everywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, everywhere that books are sold.
Thank you. This was brilliant.
I love talking to you, and you ask such unexpected and unique questions. It was really interesting.
Thank you, Neri.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Immigrant Entrepreneurs, I will be reading that book. You know what? There is so much focus on negativity around immigrants right now, and I am so fucking sick and tired of it. So yeah, let's amplify immigrant voices. Let's normalize immigrant humanity. And don't forget to buy Neri's book. This episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another story. And don't forget to follow us on our socials. If you don't know what our social media handles are, go to our website, www.immigrantlypod.com, and you'll find all the information, exciting, juicy news, and all our content there. Take care and come back next week.